Before I start, I just want to say, please, please raise your hand if you can't hear me. I know my voice gets faint. I hope I don't faint. Just kidding. the theme of the talks of this retreat is the three characteristics and the three qualities, the three areas which are sort of their opposites to be cultivated. So on Monday, Gil spoke about stability, steadiness, constancy, something about stabilizing the body and mind. And this is a quality that can support insight into impermanence. It's like when our mind moves a lot, the world and the self appear very solid, very frozen, fixed. You know, this is how it is, and it will always be like this. But when our mind settles down through stability, through steadiness of mindfulness, through stillness, we can begin to perceive impermanence in a much more subtle way. Yesterday, Gil spoke about something about cultivating the sense of well-being, the sense of ease, which can be very supportive in helping us to meet suffering. It's like, you know, when we try to be happy by clinging to some object or some sense of self, we end up suffering. But when we begin to see suffering and understand it, we can begin to disentangle from it. And what supports that is, you know, some kind of well-being, some kind of ease. So today I would like to address the third insight, which is usually translated as not-self, and look at what qualities may support us in this practice of coming to see this truth of not-self. You know, what are the qualities that can help us have a clear seeing into not-self? Not-self is often considered one of the more challenging to understand of the Buddhist teachings. You know, and it can be very easily misunderstood. You know, it's like the Buddha said there's no self, so I don't count. You know, I'm a nobody, and my needs, my hopes, my dreams, you know, what does it matter? Because there's no self in the end. That's not true at all. And so, you know, so one of the first things to say about not-self is this is an insight. You know, it's something we see. It's not meant to be a kind of a personality type or some kind of lifestyle or way of being. You know, so the goal is not to become a no-self. The goal is to, you know, is maybe to see and understand something about not-self. So as far as I know, the Buddha is not recorded as ever saying there is no self. What the Buddha taught is that when we look for a separate self, an independently existing, lasting self, when we look for that within our experience of body and mind, we can't find it. You know, not our body, not our thinking, not our consciousness, none of these can be me or mine. You know, in some fundamental way, I don't own this body. I can control it a little bit, but I can't stop it from aging. I can't stop it from getting sick. I can't stop it from dying. And so there's a great paradox in this, in that what actually supports a deep understanding, a deep seeing into this characteristic of not-self is actually what we might call in our culture a strong, healthy sense of self. you've probably heard this expression, and I think it comes from Jack Engler, who is a Vipassana teacher and a psychologist in the East Coast. And it says something like, you have to be somebody before you can be nobody. And I think we kind of intuitively know what that means. You know, so what does it mean to be somebody in this practice? You know, what qualities of the heart, what personal qualities can support us on this journey towards insight? When I first started sitting retreats and longer retreats, I was really enthusiastic about them, and I would try to explain to my friends, you know, what I was doing here. And some friends, some family, you know, oh, you know, that's nice, or, you know, that's interesting. But what I really remember is on the faces of one or two friends, the look of terror. It's like the last place I would want to be is to spend a week or a month with my own mind. So something about being here, being present with this raw, unedited version of ourselves, it takes courage. You know, to be willing to, you know, hour after hour, kind of submit ourselves to this. I often think we have to be either very wise or very wise or very desperate. And there may have been times, I'm sure, on this retreat when you start to think, you know, was this really a good idea? So something about the courage to face ourselves. The aches and pains, the repetitive thoughts, the self-judgment. Memories, stories, fantasies, fears, desires. Our entire inner landscape simply presents itself to us. And it's like a mirror. You know, this version of ourselves, moment after moment. One way that this practice is sometimes described is as a path of purification. And when something gets purified, you know, what bubbles up are all of the, you know, so-called impurities. And we get to sit with them, and, you know, they come up to be released. And, you know, at least in my experience, this can be very painful. You know, often I would have the experience of sitting on retreat, and so many things would come up, so many images and memories in my life. And especially regrets, something about regrets. And I would think, oh, I should really apologize to that person. Then I think, oh, I should apologize to that person too. And then I started making a list of all the people I should apologize to. So the root of the word courage, core, means heart. You know, and something about the heart that it takes to be with ourselves, and something, and not to flinch. You know, to be able to stay with ourselves, to accompany ourselves. I think there's a personal strength that needs to be there, and that gets developed in this process. So one illustration of personal strength we don't tend to use so much in our culture, in our California Dharma scene, but that's in the history of Buddhism, is the image of the warrior. You know, it's an archetype that goes all the way back to the time of the Buddha. I think the Buddha was from the warrior caste. You know, so something about that, something about the strength of self-mastery is an archetype that's in this practice. And when I think of some of the teachers that I've worked with, some of the Asian teachers, even for a short while, you know, someone like Harada, Shodo, Roshi, or Upandita, I mean, they have a very, it's like the lion's roar. It's like a really powerful presence, and, you know, just boom. And so something about that, something about, and of course, courage takes many forms. It doesn't have to look like the stereotypical warrior. You know, I think of a woman giving birth as one model of courage, or being liberated enough to express one's emotions, being able to cry, being able to, you know, that's a form of courage. You know, it takes courage to break down barriers, any kinds of barriers, to be a pioneer in something. It's not easy. So some inner quality, something about this fortitude that supports us to sit calmly and still, right in the middle of the storms of emotion, the storms of thinking. You know, we may have fear and we may have doubt, but we don't let it stop us. You know, one way I think about it is that usually in a regular life, I think we have something called selective awareness. You know, our awareness often cuts out. You know, we have so many ways of distracting ourselves, so many ways of simply avoiding experiencing and feeling what we're feeling. And so coming here, it's like we replace the selective awareness with this moment to moment to moment continuity, you know, and continually coming back. You know, and when we're here, it takes courage because we don't have the usual protection of this editing, you know. The usual editing of our experience through concepts, through stories. And I think when we start to develop this quality of courage, this quality of the heart, quality of the self, one of the fruits of this is a certain kind of confidence and a certain kind of trust. You know, the first way I think about it is in confidence in the Dharma, you know, confidence in this practice. You know, we begin to see through our own experience the pain of clinging, the pain of grasping. You know, it's painful. And so something about holding ourselves in awareness, holding ourselves with a kind of tenderness, it is healing and opening. You know, like Gil was saying with the beeswax, you know, something begins to soften and open and release. You know, some fixed view about ourselves or about the people around us, or some fixed view about what we need to be happy, it begins to loosen. And through this, we begin to trust the Dharma. We begin to trust this process. And this trust in the Dharma, along with the stability, you know, along with the ease, the sense of well-being that we're cultivating, this leads to a trust, a confidence in ourselves. Beautiful qualities begin to unfold within us that we can see, you know, in the sense of, I am a valuable person. You know, what I do, the choices I make are consequential and are meaningful. This kind of self-confidence helps us to overcome the hindrance of doubt. You know, we start to have the sense that we can really do this, we can walk on this path. And it's not about where we get on the path and how far we get. It's like we have a path, you know, we have a practice. Just one foot, one breath. And Buddhism supports the worth and the value of each of us. Some Buddhist traditions talk about Buddha nature. And, you know, and it's a, all beings have Buddha nature. It's not all beings minus one. You know, we each have within us the capacity to awaken. And, you know, so something about this, I think is important. It's worth saying. It's like, you know, each of us here is worthy of respect. And it takes a lot of respect. It takes a lot of self-respect to do this practice, you know, even if you don't feel it, even if you don't recognize it, you know, it's profoundly self-respectful to witness ourselves in this way. So what I would say is that this confidence, this trust, it can support us to do less and less in meditation. You know, it's like, in a way, what happens on the cushion is kind of a microcosm for our life. So, you know, whatever tendencies, whatever patterns, whatever conditioned habits we have out in the world, you know, we often enact those, you know, in our sitting, in our walking. And so I think it takes a lot of confidence and a lot of trust to do less, to let ourselves do less and less. Usually we think more mindfulness, more concentration, more. And, you know, something about that this path can unfold when we are able to simply be present, to simply be present and do less, you know, and it'd be as simple as possible. Something about simplicity. You know, Gil talked about this analogy of the muddy pond. I grew up in Brooklyn. I don't know, some of you did. Not so many ponds in Brooklyn. But we have cloudy tap water. And, you know, so... You know, just leaving it alone, letting it settle, letting something settle. You know, kind of beautiful trust can grow. And you know, so something about that, not needing to change, not needing to fix, not needing to do, but leaving it as it is. You know, we come to this practice usually because we think things as they are the problem. And maybe one of the things we discover is that the answer or the solution or something is actually things as they are. And when we're not doing so much, when we're more simple, it's like, you know, rather than being a marksman and trying to, you know, shoot down each thought, you know, it's more like we become this hallway or this breezeway, you know, and the front door is open and the back door is open, and just let everything come through. You know, anything and everything can just pass through. You become transparent. So when there's some sense of lack, when there's a voice of the inner critic, some kind of self-criticism or some doubt, you know, to remember, this comes from our thinking. You know, this comes from our conscious and unconscious habits. It's a doing, you know, it's an activity. It's not the default. You know, so whatever keeps us feeling like we're imprisoned in the small self, you know, fear or anxiety, shame, doubt, desire, you know, some kind of ancient story that we've internalized. It can be extremely helpful and extremely beneficial to locate that in the body. Patiently, lovingly, we hold it in awareness. You know, it's like the body is our doorway into the world of emotions, the world of all of these unconscious expectations that shape our experience. And so I see that as kind of the arc of the practice. You know, we start to see more and more clearly that you know, this self is a doing. This selfing is a kind of activity. We construct it. We don't realize that, but we construct it. And it takes this kind of courage and confidence and trust to be with ourselves and to really see how we do that. And as this activity of constructing the self begins to quiet, you know, what can emerge is a kind of a stillness, integrity, you know, a sense of wholeness. So there's this expression in Zen, I think it's a Suzuki Roshi quote, like, when you are you, Zen is Zen. And I take this to mean, you know, something about you have intrinsic value. You have absolute value. You can't be compared. You can't be compared to, or can't be measured against anybody else. You know, it's like you are you. Your life is your life, and you know, in a, it's sort of absurd to think that someone else can teach you how to be you. You know, so I think this is something we practice with, we cultivate, you know, we cherish the sense of our own uniqueness, you know, our own beauty. Now that I have a baby, a daughter, I've started getting more interested in one of my childhood heroes, who's Mr. Rogers. And, you know, I've heard Gil talk about Mr. Rogers as one of the American saints, one of the American, you know, real American hero. And I would watch Mr. Rogers probably, you know, it would come on four times a day on PBS in New York. And, you know, I loved everything about the show and everything about him, from the sweater zip up to down and the pick off the shoes. I learned to whistle, watching him whistle. And I was a little sad that it's not shown on TV so much anymore. It's on the web. They've got a great website, and so with our baby, you know, we kind of had this this intention to really try to keep her away from screens, you know, so no iPad, no phone, no TV, all this stuff. But so that's the ideal. And what I discovered is that she loves Mr. Rogers' songs, and she even will watch, you know, little clips of him, and it makes me so happy that she can kind of, you know, enjoy this, relate to it somehow. And you know, and as an adult, as I watch the show and as I listen to the music, I realize that he was talking to the parents just as much as he was talking to the children. And over, this message of you are special, you are unique, and you're fine just the way you are. You know, something about that. It's like, you know, I just can't hear that enough. I really enjoy it. And I guess what I want to say about this is sometimes I think about this practice as almost a kind of reparenting. You know, the way I would deal with some kind of wounds that are inside of me are very, very similar to the way that I would talk to my daughter or I would talk to a little child. You know, it's okay. It's okay. It's like, you know, just to be there, you know, or it's not real, you know, so frightened by some dream, some nightmare, you know, it's not real. So something about that, and I feel this, cultivating this, having this attitude is extremely helpful in the meditation. You know, and of course, the other side of this, you know, with our own uniqueness, comes a responsibility. You know, we have our own unique role to play. No one can do this practice for you. No one can be mindful for you. There's this great line by this Japanese Zen master who says, you know, in speaking to this, the sense of our own unique place in the world. He says, you know, what a shame. Even an important Zen master like me, I have to pee in person. And I think there's a you can't delegate some things. You know, so something about that. It's like, you know, so with courage, with confidence, with trust, we take our place on the meditation cushion. You know, and giving ourselves permission, allowing ourselves to be a strong self, be a strong self, be an authentic self. You know, having so much confidence and so much trust that we can even be nobody. Maybe that's enough. Maybe let's just sit for.